You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast hosted by the Journal Oncology and Therapy. My name is Jennifer Lloyd, and I'm an Advanced Practice Provider, or APP, at the Intermountain Medical Center Oncology Clinic in Murray, Utah. I am pleased to be joined today by Julia Batten, who is also an APP. Julia works at the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Thank you, and hello, everyone.
In this podcast, Julia and I will share with you how we as APPs can help support our patients who have metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer, or mCRPC, with alterations in homologous recombination repair, or HRR, genes. We will focus on those patients who receive treatment with the poly-ADP ribose polymerase, or PARP, inhibitor talazoparib, plus the androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, or ARPI, enzalutamide. This combination treatment was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, in 2023 for use in patients with mCRPC and HRR gene alterations. So to put this podcast into context, let's start with some background information on HRR genes and prostate cancer. HRR is a multi-gene DNA repair pathway which plays a critical role in maintaining genomic stability. About one quarter of patients with mCRPC have tumors with alterations in genes that are directly or indirectly involved in this pathway. The presence of these alterations often indicates a more aggressive prostate cancer and poorer prognosis for our patients. But the presence of these alterations also makes cancer cells more susceptible to treatment with PARP inhibitors. So now that we know patients with HRR-altered prostate cancer often have a poor prognosis and may be candidates for some targeted treatment options, let's explore how we best identify these patients. Julia, what are your thoughts on this topic?
Thanks, Jennifer. And as you mentioned, identifying patients whose tumors have HRR gene alterations is key to treating them with the most appropriate therapy. We do this by performing genetic testing on samples from the patient. The type of sample needed for testing depends on whether we are looking for somatic or germline alterations. Somatic gene alterations are those that are acquired over a patient's lifetime and are only present in the patient's tumor cells. So testing for somatic gene alterations requires a sample that includes tumor DNA. This can be obtained from either the tumor itself or from circulating tumor DNA found in a patient's blood. In contrast, germline gene alterations are inherited and present in all cells. Samples typically used for testing for germline alterations are a cheek swab, sputum, or blood draw. It is important to note that patients whose samples are negative for a germline HRR gene alteration can still have an acquired somatic HRR gene alteration. Similarly, somatic testing should not replace germline testing, as this may lead to missed germline alterations in up to one-fifth of patients. It is also important to note that germline testing can have consequences for family members, as we will explain later. As many different HRR genes can be altered, both somatic and germline testing involves the use of multi-gene panels so that many genes can be tested at the same time. Jennifer, perhaps you can build on this and give our listeners an overview of the current guidelines that provide recommendations for the genetic and biomarker testing of patients with prostate cancer.
Yes, absolutely. The American Urological Association, or AUA, and NCCN guidelines help clarify who should be tested and when germline and somatic testing are appropriate. In 2023, the AUA updated their guidelines for patients diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer. These guidelines recommended that patients with mCRPC should be offered germline testing, if not performed already, as well as somatic testing to identify DNA repair deficiencies, such as HRR gene alterations. They also point out that other genetic changes may be identified, such as microsatellite instability status, which can inform a patient's prognosis. As you have heard, germline testing may also identify other mutations with potential familial risk of associated malignancies. For patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, the AUA guidelines say that clinicians should offer germline testing and should consider somatic testing and genetic counseling. The NCCN guidelines on prostate cancer and the NCCN guidelines on genetic or familial high-risk assessment for breast, ovarian, pancreatic, and prostate cancer are applicable for patients with mCRPC. These guidelines recommend germline testing for prostate cancer susceptibility genes, such as those involved in HRR, in patients with prostate cancer at any age with any of the following. 1. Metastatic or node-positive prostate cancer. 2. High-risk or very high-risk disease. 3. Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. Or 4. A family history of breast, ovarian, pancreatic, or prostate cancer. These guidelines also say that germline testing may be considered for, 1, any patient age 55 years or younger who have prostate cancer, or 2, patients of any age with intermediate-risk prostate cancer with intraductal or cribriform histology. Limited data suggests that both of these histological patterns have increased genomic instability. These guidelines also recommend somatic testing for HRR gene alterations in patients with metastatic prostate cancer and say that it can be considered for patients with regional prostate cancer.
Thanks, Jennifer, for describing these recommendations. For more details, the AUA guidelines can be found on the AUA website in the Guidelines and Quality section, and the NCC guidelines can be found on the NCCN website in the Guidelines, Treatment by Cancer section. So genetic and biomarker testing are clearly recommended for patients with mCRPC. We therefore need to ensure that patients are tested and referred to genetic counselors who can guide them through the process and the possible implication of the results. Jennifer, do the guidelines give any recommendations for genetic counseling?
Yes, they do. The NCCN guidelines on prostate cancer strongly recommend genetic counseling if a patient has a positive germline test for a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant. Following on from this would be cascade testing of relatives to assess family members who may be at risk for developing related cancers. Genetic counseling is also recommended if no pathogenic variant is found, but there is a positive family history, or when only variants of uncertain significance are identified, to help guide patients about decisions pertaining to surveillance and future testing. However, despite these recommendations, it looks as though over half of patients with metastatic prostate cancer do not undergo genetic or biomarker testing. With understanding of the available guidelines, nurses and APPs can help educate patients and ensure that they get the appropriate tests and counseling to inform risk, prognosis, and treatment decisions.
I totally agree, and a potential targeted treatment option is the combination of a PARP inhibitor with an ARPI, as we mentioned at the start of this podcast. The combination of talazoparib plus enzalutamide has been approved by the U.S. FDA for the treatment of adult patients with HRR-G-mutated metastatic CRPC. Other PARP inhibitor and ARPI combinations approved by the U.S. FDA are olaparib or niraparib, plus abiraterone acetate and prednisone for adult patients with BRCA gene-mutated mCRPC, but we will not be discussing these here. Jennifer, I think we should first introduce the design of the TALAPRO-2 trial, which was the basis of the approval for talazoparib plus enzalutamide in the U.S.
Good idea, Julia. The combination of talazoparib plus enzalutamide was investigated in the TALAPRO-2 trial by comparing its efficacy and safety versus enzalutamide alone as a first-line treatment in patients with mCRPC. The trial is an ongoing, double-blind, randomized phase 3 study, so some patients are still taking part in the study, but no new patients will be enrolled. Patients received either talazoparib 0.5 mg daily, reduced to 0.35 mg daily if they had moderate renal impairment, or matching placebo, and all patients received enzalutamide 160 mg daily. Before randomization, all patients prospectively provided solid tumor tissue and or blood-based samples, which were assessed for the presence of HRR gene alterations, but not all patients in the trial had HRR gene alterations. The first patients were enrolled into an unselected cohort regardless of HRR gene alteration status. This unselected cohort included 169 patients with tumor HRR gene alterations, known as HRR deficient, and 636 patients without tumor HRR gene alterations. An additional 230 patients who were selected for tumor HRR gene alterations were then recruited. These 230 additional patients were combined with the 169 previously enrolled patients to complete a combined HRR deficient cohort of 399 patients. This HRR deficient cohort had tumors with one or more alterations in at least one of 12 HRR genes. The HRR genes assessed were ATM, ATR, BRCA1, BRCA2, CDK12, CHEK2, BANCA, MLH1, MRE11A, NBN, PALB2, and RAD51C. In line with the approval of talazoparib plus enzalutamide for HRR gene mutated mCRPC in the U.S., the HRR deficient cohort will be the focus of our discussion.
Thanks, Jennifer. This sets the scene nicely for us to look at the main efficacy results in the HRR deficient cohort. We should look first at the primary endpoint of the trial. This was radiographic progression-free survival by blinded independent central review. For this podcast, we'll refer to this as PFS. The primary analysis of this endpoint was conducted after a median follow-up of approximately 17 months at a cutoff date of October 3rd, 2022. In this cohort, treatment with talazoparib plus enzalutamide significantly improved PFS versus placebo plus enzalutamide with a hazard ratio of 0.45, indicating a 55% reduction in the risk of disease progression or death. For further specific values, we refer you to the original 2024 publication by Fizazi et al. In the journal Nature Medicine. At this data cutoff, the median PFS was 13.8 months for the placebo plus enzalutamide group and had not been reached for the talazoparib plus enzalutamide group. PFS was analyzed again at the time of the final analysis of overall survival, after a median follow-up of approximately 44 months at a cutoff date of September 3rd, 2024. At this later time, the median PFS was 30.7 months for talazoparib plus enzalutamide versus 12.3 months for placebo plus enzalutamide, and the corresponding hazard ratio was 0.47. If we look at the PFS results for particular HRR genes, patients with mCRPC harboring BRCA1 and/or BRCA2 alterations experience the most benefit from treatment with talazoparib plus enzalutamide. Post hoc analysis at the time of the primary PFS analysis demonstrated that patients with mCRPC harboring BRCA1 and 2 alterations had a lower risk of radiographic progression or death, with a hazard ratio of 0.2, indicating an 80% reduction in risk. For patients with mCRPC harboring non-BRCA1 or 2 HRR alterations, the hazard ratio at the time of the primary analysis was 0.68, correlating with a 32% reduction of disease progression or death. Now, Jennifer, I understand that although patients in the TALAPRO-2 trial could have received prior treatment with an ARPI, not many did.
Yes, that's right. A limitation of the TALAPRO-2 trial is that, when it was carried out, ARPIs were not commonly used to treat castration-sensitive prostate cancer, and their use has since become more commonplace. Among the HRR-deficient cohort, 34 patients had received a prior ARPI, either abiraterone or orterinol. In these patients, the hazard ratio for PFS was 0.53, which is similar to that in the whole cohort. Although the confidence interval was wide at 0.2 to 1.42, so the benefit of talazoparib plus enzalutamide in patients who have received a prior ARPI requires confirmation.
Thanks, Jennifer. So we've discussed the results for the primary analysis of PFS. At that time, the results for overall survival, which was a key secondary endpoint of TALAPRO-2, were immature. The final overall survival analysis has now been carried out. Perhaps you can explain what this showed.
Yes, the results at the final analysis in the HRR-deficient cohort showed that treatment with talazoparib plus enzalutamide significantly improved overall survival versus placebo plus enzalutamide, with a hazard ratio of 0.62, indicating a 38% reduction in the risk of death. The median overall survival was 45.1 months versus 31.1 months, respectively. Again, patients with mCRPC harboring BRCA1 and 2 alterations seem to experience the most benefit from treatment with talazoparib plus enzalutamide, with a hazard ratio of 0.5, indicating a 50% reduction in the risk of death. By comparison, patients with mCRPC harboring non-BRCA1 and 2 alterations had a hazard ratio of 0.73, indicating a 27% reduction in risk of death. So talazoparib plus enzalutamide improved both PFS and overall survival. Julia, we know that quality of life is a huge importance for patients with mCRPC. So what happened to the patient's quality of life with this combination?
Together with the observed efficacy benefits, definitive deterioration in the global health status quality of life measure was delayed by treatment with talazoparib plus enzalutamide compared with placebo plus enzalutamide in patients with mCRPC harboring HRR gene alterations at the primary analysis. Patient-reported quality of life was then maintained with extended follow-up.
Thanks, Julia. Now, in addition to considering the potential benefits for a patient starting talazoparib plus enzalutamide, we need to consider how the likely adverse events will affect the patient and how these can be managed to minimize their impact. What information about the talazoparib plus enzalutamide combination do you think would be crucial for nurses and APPs to know?
Indeed, it's important for nurses and APPs to be familiar with the safety profile of talazoparib plus enzalutamide. This will help them to monitor patients for potential adverse events and appropriately educate patients who are about to start treatment. Let us look at the common adverse events in patients in the HRR deficient cohort treated with talazoparib plus enzalutamide from the primary analysis of the TALAPRO-2 trial at the data cutoff of October 2022. Common grade 3 or higher, which are severe, hematologic adverse events in at least 5% of patients were anemia, 41%, neutropenia in 19%, thrombocytopenia in 7%, and leukopenia in 6% of patients. Common non-hematologic adverse events of any grade in at least 20% of patients were fatigue, defined as both fatigue and asthenia, in 49%, nausea in 21%, and decreased appetite in 20%. Importantly, there were no new safety signals identified when the safety data were analyzed at the time of final analysis after an extended follow-up of nearly 2 years.
Thank you for telling us about those frequently occurring adverse events. How were dose modification strategies used to manage these adverse events, especially the hematologic events, and did patients end up stopping treatment because of adverse events?
In total, 10% of patients permanently discontinued talazoparib due to adverse events, most commonly anemia in 4% of patients. But for most patients, dose interruptions or reductions were used to manage adverse events. Dose interruption of talazoparib due to adverse events occurred in 58% of patients and was also most commonly due to anemia in 42%, and also to neutropenia in 15% and thrombocytopenia in 9%. Similarly, dose reduction of talazoparib due to adverse events occurred in 52% of patients and was also most commonly due to anemia in 43%, neutropenia in 15%, and thrombocytopenia in 6%. So it's clear that dose modifications are widely used to manage hematologic adverse events associated with talazoparib plus enzalutamide. This really raises the question of what nurses and APPs can do to help with the monitoring and management of adverse events. Jennifer, what are your thoughts?
There are many ways that we as nurses and APPs can help these aspects of treatment. Regarding the frequency of monitoring, we need to ensure that all patients being treated with talazoparib have complete blood counts monitored monthly and as clinically indicated. And for patients who have grade 3 or 4 events of anemia, neutropenia, or thrombocytopenia, the dosing of talazoparib should be put on hold and blood counts monitored weekly. In addition, we should encourage the early detection of adverse events by educating patients and their caregivers on the early signs of common adverse events. For anemia, these can include fatigue, dizziness, and shortness of breath, since early intervention can help limit treatment interruptions. Nurses and APP should screen patients for dose-limiting effects such as nausea and fatigue and treat with antiemetics and fatigue management as soon as possible. Nurses and APPs can also ensure that patients with persistent hematologic toxicities are referred to a hematologist for further evaluation and can work within their established protocols to manage dose modifications. Julia, do you have anything to add based on your clinical experience?
Yes, I think it's worth noting that for older or frail patients, I would consider seeing them 2 weeks after starting therapy to evaluate how they are tolerating therapy. If it's not possible to evaluate them in clinic, I would schedule a check-in telephone call or a virtual visit at 2 weeks.
Thanks, Julia. So we've talked about dose reduction interruptions, making this a good point for us to discuss the recommended dosing of talazoparib for patients with mCRPC and dose modifications after adverse events occur.
Yes, I agree. So for patients with HRR gene-alterated mCRPC, the recommended starting dose of talazoparib is 0.5 milligrams taken orally once daily in combination with enzalutamide. And this should be modified to a starting dose of 0.35 milligrams once daily for patients with moderate renal impairment and 0.25 milligrams for patients with severe renal impairment. The talazoparib capsules are taken whole, with or without food, at roughly the same time each day. And if the patient vomits or misses a dose of talazoparib, they should take their next dose at the usual time and should not take an extra dose. Jennifer, it would be great to get your insights on how dosing of talazoparib can be modified to manage adverse events.
Certainly. An interruption or reduction in dosing of talazoparib may be needed depending on the type of adverse event and its severity. If a dose reduction is needed, the first dose reduction is to 0.35 milligrams, the second is to 0.25 milligrams, and the third to 0.1 milligram each once daily. For grade 1 or 2, that is mild or moderate adverse events, there is no requirement to interrupt or reduce the dose of talazoparib. However, grade 1 or 2 anemia may warrant dose interruption or reduction if clinically symptomatic. For example, if the patient has fatigue. Julia, I think you may have another example from clinical practice.
Yes, I would also suggest a dose interruption or reduction in an older or frail patient if grade 1 or 2 anemia was impacting their functional status in a way that puts them at risk for a fall.
Thanks, Julia. And for grade 3 or 4 events, which are those that are severe or life-threatening, it is generally recommended to hold talazoparib and monitor until the event resolves to appropriate levels. As you mentioned earlier, hematologic toxicities are some of the most common adverse events associated with talazoparib plus enzalutamide in the TALAPRO-2 trial. If anemia, neutropenia, or thrombocytopenia occur in patients, APPs need to be familiar with the recommended dosing modifications to optimize treatment.
Absolutely. And there are further recommendations for dose modifications after the occurrence of hematologic adverse events. If they occur, blood count monitoring may be increased from monthly to weekly, as mentioned before. Then, if blood counts recover, talazoparib can be restarted at a reduced dose. But if low values persist, more than 8 weeks for anemia or more than 4 weeks for neutropenia or thrombocytopenia, the recommendation is to discontinue talazoparib.
And permanent discontinuation of talazoparib may also be required to manage non-hematologic adverse events, including laboratory events of grade 3 lasting for more than 14 days or of grade 4 lasting for more than 3 days, and non-laboratory grade 4 events with some exceptions. Non-laboratory grade 4 events that do not require discontinuation are vomiting that responds to intervention within 3 days, diarrhea managed to grade 2 or lower within 3 days, and constipation managed to grade 2 or lower within 7 days. The full details of talazoparib dosing modifications in hematologic adverse events and grade 3 or 4 non-hematologic adverse events can be found in the U.S. prescribing information or in our previous publication.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'd also like to note that with respect to dose modifications, while the recommended guidelines for dose modifications are applicable to most patients, there are some patients who may require dose modification sooner or for a lower grade due to their unique clinical circumstances. So it's always important to assess the impact of the adverse event on the patient's quality of life and safety when making decisions about dose modifications.
I totally agree. It's clear that nurses and APPs can play a crucial role in educating patients to understand the dosing regimen of talazoparib and that dose modifications are a standard procedure for managing adverse events. I also think it's important to reiterate to our listeners that most patients with grade 3 or 4 cytopenias are able to tolerate these and continue talazoparib after an initial dose modification. Thank you, Julia, for joining me today to discuss the role of oncology nurses and APPs in the treatment of patients with HRR-deficient mCRPC receiving talazoparib plus enzalutamide. We would like to re-emphasize the importance of HRR testing for patients with prostate cancer, as this informs patient eligibility for treatment, such as with talazoparib plus enzalutamide, and helps to identify familial risk of particular cancers. Nurses and APPs can help to educate patients about genetic and biomarker testing. Furthermore, nurses and APPs should be familiar with the safety profile of talazoparib plus enzalutamide. They can then monitor for and educate patients on the likely adverse events, the need for regular monitoring, and the need to report any event as soon as possible so that appropriate referrals and dose modifications can be implemented. Thank you to all of our listeners. We presented a lot of information today. As a reminder, the key information discussed here can be found in the TELEPRO 2 trial publication, the U.S. prescribing information, and the AUA and NCCN guidelines.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.